Kia ora and welcome to Good Fellow Podcasts. This episode is kindly supported by the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners, the Auckland faculty. I'm Dr. Louise Kugler, a specialist GP, and I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Helen Keneally to our podcast. Today we are unravelling frailty. We will delve into the importance of understanding frailty, explore methods for assessment, and discuss holistic management approaches. Helen is a geriatrician and general physician working at Counties Manukau Health and Green Lane Medical Specialists. She is the chair of the National Medication Optimisation Group for Somerset Villages. She has completed the Monash Short Course in Perioperative Medicine, and she sees a wide range of conditions and performs home visits. She also has experience in capacity assessments and legal reports for clients and the court. Kia ora, Helen, and welcome to the podcast.
Kia ora, Louise. Thanks for having me.
So we're delving into the topic of frailty. Just to start with, Helen, I wonder if we can define frailty.
So frailty is something as doctors that we all know it, right? When we see it, we definitely know when someone isn't frail. And there's actually been quite a lot of work behind the scenes to try and tease out a more scientific definition. And as we know, there's often research definitions and ways of assessing frailty that might be different from how we would do it as clinicians on a day-to-day basis. First important thing to remember is that frailty is a long-term condition and a chronic condition. So that's sort of bread and butter, right, for GPs and physicians. One way to define it would be to say it's a state of increased vulnerability to stressors due to age-related decline and physiologic reserve across a variety of systems, such as the neuromuscular system, the metabolic, and the immune systems. So what do we see in regard to that? Well, in reality, we see changes, for example, in a patient's mobility and their strength. Endurance is really key, nutrition and physical activity. One thing I find interesting in most of the definitions, and indeed the scores that we'll talk about a bit later, is that cognition is actually often not explicitly included in definitions, both in research and in clinical use. There's a little bit of debate around including cognition. I really feel strongly as a geriatrician that cognition definitely contributes to frailty. So I do always take it into account when I'm considering the frailty of a patient. What you're left with, if you want to try and explain frailty to patients and families, I think something that they tend to understand quite well is that a frail older adult is less able to adapt to a stressor and less able to recover, because it's quite a multidimensional syndrome. It does tend to occur later in life and be associated with decline. But it's really that vulnerability that we see in patients that really needs to be recognised. And that's because of that weakness and that decreased physiologic reserve.
Thank you, Helen. That's fantastic. So thinking about frailty in the New Zealand context, how common is frailty in New Zealand?
When you ask a question like that, the difficulty is it depends what population you're talking about, right? The prevalence is going to completely depend on where you measure it. So, for example, if you look at a community dwelling population, the rate of frailty is going to be lower than in an inpatient hospital setting. And again, different somewhere perhaps like an aged residential care setting. So there's been lots of studies all over the world trying to give us some estimates, but I'd really just take them as estimates, okay, because you've really got to look at where they've measured our frailty and, of course, how they've measured it and all those things. But let's just throw some numbers out there. So evidence that I've read in community dwelling adults, I mean, really the rates vary, is 4% to 60%. So you can see the bracket's kind of too wide to really help us understand about frailty in that sense. I noted a systematic review where they looked at a pooled frailty prevalence. And that was across, I think it was 21 community dwelling study cohorts. That got frailty prevalence of around 11%. And then if you come into hospitals and look at frailty, obviously it's going to be higher. And again, in the literature, you can find anything from, you know, 25% to 80%. So I think what we know is that it's common. You know, we all see it and we see it frequently in our practices, but I think it's really hard to put numbers on it.
Thinking about those student populations where frailty happens more commonly, what populations do we need to think about?
So frailty, as we define it, is age-related. So we are going to see more frailty as people get older. So obviously, the older your patients are, the more likely, therefore, you are to see frailty. There's definitely an association with people who have chronic conditions and, of course, comorbidities. So more than one and lots of conditions, which again is bread and butter for GPs and physicians, and anyone with disability. So I guess there's a lot of background factors there that could increase the likelihood of a person in a population or populations, depending where you're looking at, to have some frailty. I think the important thing to remember is that everyone, so all of us, actually lose muscle strength. We always lose muscle mass at about 1% to 3% per annum. And this is really marked then when you get into that older age, and especially when you get very old. And of course, from a hospital perspective, what do we do with patients? Well, we stick them in bed and they actually don't move a lot, initially because they're sick. And then there's a lot of other factors that can play into that, including poor nutrition. And of course, if you're sick, you have increased catabolism because of your illness, right? And that accelerates the sarcopenia acutely. Bearing in mind that we all get some degree of sarcopenia as we age, and that progressive loss of skeletal muscle mass and strength, that feeds into what I talked about before when we define frailty. So the loss of physiological reserve in the neuromuscular system being one of the really key factors. And that's due to muscle fibre loss, for example, muscle fibre atrophy. And remember, we use the term multidimensional. So the interplay between things like nutrition, hormones, metabolism, and immunological factors. So there's a lot of things to bear in mind there, Louise.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, we see time and time again that our patients do have an illness or an event or are hospitalised, and they come out and it just takes them so much longer to get back to where they were. And sometimes they never get back.
And I think you've hit the nail on the head there, because that is the definition of frailty, right? So that's what we all know as clinicians. And indeed, when you present it to families and patients, it very much just how you've worded it. People click, don't they? And they say, oh, yeah, okay. We haven't thought of mum as frail, but when we look at it like that, we can see that, because that is what we see, sadly, with hospital admissions, isn't it? That they just take so long to bounce back. They don't bounce back. And I spend a lot of time talking to patients with a major event, saying you'll always look back at this event and say yourself or your older person was never the same again. And that's kind of a key understanding as we go and talk on a bit further, just for patients and families to understand that interaction. And it really helps, doesn't it, with goal setting and being realistic, which is something that we can sometimes struggle with, I think, with families and patients.
So thinking about risk factors, Helen, particularly associated with frailty, what are the risk factors?
We're going to divide that into four domains, okay? So first of all, let's think about demographic and social factors. So we've already said age. Unfortunately, being female puts us at a slightly increased risk of frailty. Now, ethnic minorities, in particular our Māori Pacifica, are unfortunately at more risk of frailty, is how we understand it. We don't have a lot of data around that at the moment. Lower education levels, low socioeconomic status. There is an association with people who live alone or are lonely or otherwise socially isolated. And of course, those not accessing healthcare. Then we're going to take a second category. We're going to say clinical factors. So I've already said if you've got, you know, multiple chronic comorbidities, that's going to increase your risk of frailty. When it comes to weight, either end of the spectrum can be a risk factor for frailty, so obesity, but as well as malnutrition and low body weight. And it's also really important for us to understand and recognise that people who are obese can be malnourished. And that came up recently with a pilot trial we did at Middlemore with perioperative medicine. And I think that's something that we do actually overlook. So it's really important for us as clinicians to remember that point. I'm going to put impaired cognition in there because, as I said, I think that's a really important factor. Mental health, particularly depression, we know comes into play, and polypharmacy would come under that bracket. The third group is lifestyle factors. So physical inactivity, right? That's going to play into that whole role of sarcopenia. So if you're physically inactive, then you're going to have more muscle loss, worsening problems with your balance, and therefore more sarcopenia, more frailty. Let's talk about diet. So obviously having a good, well-rounded diet is really important. So in particular, if you've got low protein intake, that would be associated with frailty. Smoking, we don't know about vaping yet, but we could perhaps assume that it would be associated with frailty. And of course, increased alcohol intake. And the final factor, which is a really interesting area of research, is biological factors. We know that people who are frail often have elevated CRPs, you know, with those patients, and you just get this chronically slightly elevated CRP, and you're not quite sure how far to take it or how far to look. We think that some of that is a sign of frailty. Elevated cytokines, endocrine factors, perhaps androgen, IGF-1 deficiency, definitely micronutrient deficiency, which includes vitamin D, which of course I think is clinicians, we're quite good at thinking about and replacing. And there is a lot of research that ultimately in the cycle of frailty, there seems to be an imbalance between the pro and the anti-inflammatory cytokines. So if you read the literature, things like TNF-alpha come up, interleukin-1s come up, and interleukin-6. So there isn't any specific therapies, for example, that have come out of that, but it's obviously really interesting research, and you know, who knows where it might lead in the future.
It feels like avoiding frailty is the thing that we should be doing. So what strategies can we suggest, and how can we support our patients to avoid them becoming frail?
So I think with the growing awareness that all of us want to age well, I think people in our age group are probably already starting to think about that actually. And that's a good thing, because I think it will start raising awareness, and of course it will also have a flow and effect that will start influencing the generation above us. And I see that in clinic rooms actually as a routine now. I think there is quite a lot that we can do, and I think our generation is going to come through with a much more positive mindset around that. And there are definitely ways that we can support, you know, our current patients. The biggest one has got to be keeping them moving, right? So we need to encourage any sort of physical activity that we can. And if that's a walk, that's fantastic. I mean, some people are still fit enough that they can do things like swimming. But look, even just getting in a pool and going for, you know, the aqua walking, just walking in a pool, just getting that movement in the body is awesome. Exercycles at home are actually quite a common adjunct that I hear people using. And there's even those little kettle ones where you can use your hands or your feet. So you could have it under a desk, or they could sit and, you know, watch TV and just pedal away with their feet, or have it up on the kitchen counter or the table, something like that. The other thing is to think about walking groups, because humans are social beings. So if you can find an activity, whatever that might be, with other people, that's always fantastic. And we sort of talk about, you know, doing 30 minutes, 3 to 5 times a week, you know, those sorts of ideals. And even then, a lot of patients will look at me as if I'm mad. That's never going to happen. But even if we can get them doing 10 minutes, you know, every second day to start with, and even if they could just do 10 minutes in the morning and then go 10 minutes in the evening. So that 30 minutes doesn't have to be continuous. If for whatever reason the patient doesn't feel that that's a possibility for them, and there can be lots of reasons for that. You know, I've met patients who, for example, might actually be scared to go for a walk in their local neighbourhood, or don't necessarily want to stray too far or something like that. So there could be a lot of reasons why to them 10 minutes is okay, but anything longer is not. Realising that you can do those short walks frequently, I think, is also really important. Our role, I think, is, as you say, to support, right, and encourage, and try and help them to think of whatever strategies they can to achieve the goal that we want. Of course, if you're in a frail situation, and particularly people falling and things like that, I think the work that our physios do is fantastic. And they can, of course, help with strength and balance programming for falls prevention. That's, of course, a different topic in itself, but obviously sometimes we do need to involve our allied health to help. We know that keeping socially connected is really vital, and that will also help us avoid frailty. So when we went through those four factors, we talked about, you know, isolation, loneliness, living alone being a risk factor for developing frailty. I mean, today there's a variety of ways that you can keep socially connected, and in some ways being connected online is a good thing. Sometimes it can be a bad thing. But for some patients, it does open up that world. You know, they have the iPad or the iPhone, and they can FaceTime, you know, with their children or grandchildren overseas in a way that is much more interactive, really, isn't it, than just the odd phone call or email or message. So I think allowing time for that's really important. Obviously, in person's, you know, best if they can. And if you can combine, as I said before, like a walking group, so you've got a social activity with a physical one, well, then we've really hit the jackpot, haven't we? So social connection is really key. And I think it's also really important that we help to support older people, keep their brains stimulated, right? And that just is any way that interests them. For some people, they still want to just do a word search, you know, a good old pen and paper, which is fantastic. There's so many apps and options nowadays online, isn't there? You know, the Wordle that I'm sure lots of people listening to the podcast love. And there's just such an array of things that can be done online. There's the Elevate app. There's so many interesting apps. It doesn't actually matter what they do. It just matters that they're doing something in a variety. So I try and encourage patients to do something every day. You know, word search one day, crossword the next, Sudoku the next. Really anything that keeps them stimulated. And I wouldn't downplay things like, you know, reading, listening to podcasts, here we go, listening to music. And we know that music's really great for our brains, you know, watching documentaries, gosh, getting out to a movie if you can. Again, that crosses off a social aspect as well as stimulating the brain. So there are lots of ways. As I say, I think our generation's going to come through with a more positive mindset, with us, a lot of us normalizing these sorts of activities anyway in our current lives, that will help us to avoid frailty for as long as possible. And therefore, we need to just be brave and translate those ideas to the older generation and just help support them in finding ways that suit them within their current physical and mental abilities to be able to stay as active physically and socially as possible to avoid frailty.
So thinking about frailty and how you see frailty presenting in patients, what would be the most common ways you see frailty presenting?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And it would be interesting to hear if it's similar for GPs. But for me, as a geriatrician and general physician, I think one of the most common ones I see is actually weight loss. So in weight loss, of course, as doctors, we're kind of primed, aren't we, that it's our job to make sure there's nothing sinister, you know, and we're always worried, you know, could there be cancer underlying and all those sorts of things. And we certainly do need to do that. But often you don't find anything. And often it probably does come down to frailty and or declining dementia. I think fatigue is also a really common complaint. And again, that's part of, when we get down to the more about the definitions and how you assess frailty, then you'll see that fatigue is part of the criteria for the different stages of frailty. So the more fatigued you are, helps move you down in a bad way to be more frail. Because when you get more sedentary, you're doing less and you're sitting more, and it becomes a cycle, doesn't it? So that then your exercise tolerance is decreased. So then actually you feel more fatigued, and then you're not likely to be very active. It all becomes quite a downward spiral. I think people who are becoming more and more socially isolated is always a flag to me, that they're not able to get out anymore. Could there be declining cognition there as well? Could there be depression? We don't want to miss anything like that, but it can be a sign of frailty that they're not able to physically feel confident to go out and be socially interacting. I see quite a lot of people with declining cognition, which, as I say, I think is quite important to bear in mind with the frailty assessment. That concept that you mentioned before about not recovering well from an insult, you know, I'm sure as GPs you see it all the time. So the person who comes out of hospital, and actually I just saw someone this week who had a really bad illness, and, you know, 6 weeks later was said, well, I haven't recovered. So what's wrong? You know, I should be back to normal by now. You know, well, that's not always the case, is it? If you have a bad flu or a bad pneumonia, a fracture, for example, and they're just not bouncing back, I think that's a big flag for frailty. I want to talk about falls being strongly linked to frailty. And I think that's a really important one to consider. And it also helps to explain and help the understanding of the concept of frailty a bit more. Because the reason that falling is associated with frailty comes down to the fact that when a complex system fails, and humans are very complex, They fail first with their higher order functions, okay? So those are things that require coordinated, integrated, and precise interaction between many components. And walking is absolutely a higher order function, right? So a frail older person who's kind of on the threshold of failure will present with a fall, despite there not really seemingly being much going on. You know, you often see that patient who starts falling and you just think, how did that happen? What tipped them over to make them fall? And you can't find a defined medical reason, and that therefore could be a sign of increasing frailty. And that's why it's so important that we do a really comprehensive and multifaceted assessment and put in management programs specifically to reduce falls in older people. I have seen and wonder about people when they present with delirium, for example. So obviously that's a sign that, you know, again, a complex system of cognition has failed. Another one's urinary incontinence, because they've just reached that point where they're just not able to get to the bathroom in time, for example. Because frailty is going to adversely affect your functional independence. We have some pretty critical basic mobility skills that we all want to maintain, which include things like just getting out of bed. We take this for granted, but you know, when you're frail, getting out of bed is a problem. Just standing up from your chair, walking a short distance, for example, to get to the toilet, and even getting off a toilet. So a lot of toilets are quite low, which is why over-the-toilet frames can be really helpful for patients. So not only does it raise the level of where you're sitting, but also, of course, they have some handrails. So that if you're frail, so that your muscle quad strength isn't as good, then you can also use your hand to help push you up so that you can remain independent getting off the toilet. I think you can see that frailty can present in many different ways. I don't think that there's one sort of typical standout presentation. I think it can actually masquerade and be something that we need to think about in all of these presentations.
So you mentioned assessment of frailty and how important that is. So I wonder if we can just touch on that for a moment. So how do you assess frailty?
So I certainly take weight as a really good measure. In the public outpatient clinics, we don't necessarily measure weight every time they come. I think we should. And I do that in the private clinic, because I think that's quite a good sensitive early sign. Then, of course, there's cognition. So in a lot of my assessments, I'll do a mini ACE. Obviously, I have an hour with patients, so I have much more time than GPs have to be able to do these things. But I find that's quite useful, even if it's just a baseline, because, if I've got a baseline with good cognition, and then they come back in six months and that started to fall off, and the weight started to fall off, then you can start to have those flags raised for frailty a bit sooner. Appetite. So I always ask patients about the appetite, and obviously that feeds into weight. But there does seem to be a drop off of appetite as well, I think, that comes with, you know, that loss of weight and also with a decline in cognition. If you look at the literature, there are some things that we don't tend to do, but we could argue about that. But things, ultimately, it's about low muscle weight, right? So there's very good evidence that if we had things like pincers and checked hand grip strength, that would be a very sensitive way to pick up frailty. But look, I mean, we don't actually do that. So a more practical way of doing it is looking at walking speed. So we know that as people get frailer, they walk more slowly. So formal ways of doing that are, you know, the timed up and go test. So just seeing how quickly, seeing A, that people can stand up independently from a chair, and B, how quickly they can do that. Physios, of course, have a longer test, the 6-minute walk test. So they have that sort of formal assessment that they may choose to do in their repertoire of tests. But I think if you want to sort of, what can I do in the office, particularly as a GP, I think all of us, our assessment of the patient starts the minute we see them in the waiting room, doesn't it? And if they can't get out of the chair without needing help from someone or using the armrests, I'm sure that all the listeners' alarm bells go off, don't you, to think, oh, this patient looks a bit frail.
So thinking about putting an objective score on frailty, I wonder if there are any frailty scores that you use and are validated and easy and practical to use.
Actually, Louise, there are lots of frailty scores. There have been a huge number proposed over the years, and, you know, some different ones are used in different places. Some are definitely best left to researchers, I think, because they're really not practical for day-to-day clinical use. So they involve things like the hand grip strength, which we just don't have access to. So you'll hear about all sorts of ones. The things you might have heard of might be Freed, SOF, the Rockwood. I think most people would have heard of Rockwood and Edmonton frailty scores. These are modified frailty index. So there's lots and lots of ones to think about. At a practical level, because we all just want one that we can actually do in the clinic, my go-to is the clinical frailty score. And I think that one is really being picked up by most people now. And I think it's entirely realistic for general practitioners, as well as surgeons and everybody else, partly because there's a visual chart with real clear names and very clear stages. As listeners, everyone would want to be in stage one, which is very fit. And none of us would want to be in stage nine, which is terminal. It's got really easy to understand explanations beside each one. So you can sort of read through them and have a think about where patients would fit in that process. So the clinical frailty scale does have an online training module, and that's really helpful if you want to start using this in clinical practice, which I do routinely now. You obviously want to understand how to use it. And I even think it's worth doing that, you know, every 6 to 12 months, just to refresh yourself, particularly if you're someone who's not seeing older people often. I'm starting to try and actually record clinical frailty scores in my letters, or patient notes or discharge summaries, to sort of start that process of documenting frailty as a routine. And the other thing I really like about the clinical frailty score is because of the way it's presented, it's not medical jargon, it's not difficult to access. So I can actually bring it up on a screen and show it to patients and their families and say, hey, look, well, where do you think you sit in this? I'm going to read you out the definition of, you know, a CFS5 patient. And let's see if that rings true to you, because I really think probably you're down at the 6 level. And sometimes patients want to be a bit in between. So sometimes patients say, well, can I be 5.5 or 6.5? But even that's helpful, because then you can still say, well, you know, the patient feels that they're here, but the family feel that they're here. And then you can document that. And I think it's really useful to be able to have that conversation and involve the patient and the family into those discussions. So that's one of the other reasons I really like the clinical frailty score.
So if we don't manage frailty well, what are the adverse outcomes for our patients?
Yeah, there are a lot of adverse outcomes that we're finding are associated with frailty. So that's a super important thing to think about. We know that frailty increases your risk for falls, which we've talked about. Institutionalization, so going into aged residential care, you know, not the townhouse apartment versions, but, you know, rest homes and private hospitals, and increased disability and, unfortunately, obviously, death. I think it is often overlooked, and it is an important predictor of prognosis. It can also help us think about length of stay in hospital. And of course, helps us in the setting of shared goals of care to have that shared understanding with family as to why it's important. And involving the patient and the family in those discussions, as you say, helps to reset those expectations and to understand the consequences and why, you know, poor outcomes might occur for their loved one, or why they might take longer to recover than, for example, you know, someone else they've heard of. Who came in and, you know, had a fractured hip and was home 3 days later. Why did that happen for that person, but it's not happening for my mum? So I think often those things can help put those sorts of issues into context for people.
And finally, Helen, effectively managing a frail patient will improve their quality of life and perhaps longevity and overall health. So how can we effectively manage our frail patients?
So that's a really tricky one, isn't it? Because I think particularly for GP, because it really involves a multidisciplinary team assessment and treatment plan to do it properly. Where I work in an inpatient rehabilitation unit at Counties Manukau Health, of course, we have all of that at our disposal, right? So we have patients who stay with us for 17, 14 days and have access to doctors, nurses, healthcare assistants, physios, rehab assistants, OTs, social workers, dietitians, pharmacists, you know, so we really can deliver that multidisciplinary team approach. So I think that is probably harder for GPs. We want to highlight the importance of exercise. So as I said before, it's really important that we have access to physiotherapy for those that need it. There are, of course, funded strength and balance programs for prevention in this country. Which is accessed via livestronger.org.nz. So people can go in and put in their local area and find some group classes near them. I have heard that they're varying quality. So I do warn patients if they go to one and they go to a hall and someone puts a DVD in and leaves them to it, that perhaps they might look again for one that has a little bit more human attendance, shall we say. I do want to just highlight that actually Tai Chi is an activity that we recommend often in this area to help frail patients improve their quality of life. Tai Chi is thought to improve strength, balance, prevent falls, and actually we believe can help with cognition as well. So there's multiple reasons to consider Tai Chi, and you can start doing these things just seated. There's lots of activities that one can do sitting down that is going to still be beneficial compared to doing nothing. And I think that's got to be one of the mantras, is it's better to do something, even if it's something little, than do nothing. I think we can support our patients nutrition-wise. Again, in hospital, I have the luxury of having all the patients get a dietetic screen and some input. I should say that actually our allied health staffing levels in hospital are disastrous, so it's not that all the patients get these things, but in the ideal sense, they're supposed to. Maximising dairy intake, I think, is one that we can really, in a practical sense, pass on to our patients for those that are able to and happy to eat dairy. So that gives them good calcium and vitamin D, for example. That's going to help with bone and muscle strength. And of course, we want to make sure they're getting all the micronutrients, getting in that fruit and vegetables. And I think it's really easy for us to forget, I mean, even in our own busy lives, but when you're an older person living at home by yourself, you're not going out and getting fresh fruit and veggies every couple of days, are you? And you also perhaps don't have the hand strength to be cutting up an apple. You might not have the teeth strength to be biting an apple. So they may, in a sense, eat actually less fruit and vegetables, and of course they're expensive as well. So again, we want to think outside the box and think how they can be getting fruit and vegetable intake. I mean, my understanding is that frozen vegetables and frozen fruit, you know, maintain all the same nutritional benefits. So obviously that's a way that elderly people could have it in the freezer, and therefore, you know, buying it in bulk is a bit less cheaper, and they're able to access small amounts that they need over time without having to get fresh fruit and vegetables constantly, which can be troubling. And I think optimising comorbidities, that's where we come in as doctors, isn't it? As GPs and geriatricians and general physicians, we want to optimise all their comorbidities, which can be easier said than done. A lot of that comes down to rationalising polypharmacy, and I'm sure that all the listeners are aware of stop, start and stop frail to help guide you. Often what we're doing is de-prescribing, isn't it? Rationalising and getting rid of medications. I think psychologically supporting our patients and their families on the impact of any illness, adjusting those expectations, talking through the disappointment or the negative feelings that might come from having not bounced back. I think a lot of patients feel like they didn't try hard enough. Or their families, we often see families who think that, you know, mum and dad just was trying. Well, that's actually not quite right. You know, the element of frailty is working against them. And so that's why they're not able to perhaps progress in the way that we want. I think we need to keep our eyes out for patients that do need formal psychology input, which of course is difficult to access in this country at times. And of course, psychiatry input when needed. Of course, you and I can manage, you know, some degrees of depression and anxiety, which are common in these settings. But if we need further input, then obviously we need to be able to seek that out. I also want to put a plug in for many of the amazing community organisations out there that can support our patients. You know, Dementia Auckland, the Parkinson Society, Stroke Foundation, I'm sure you've got many that you refer to as GPs, that provide, you know, really amazing support in a very practical way and help hook patients in to a lot of the things that are available in our community that can help support them on their journey with frailty and older age. I think all of the things that we're doing, we're trying to help improve what quality of life we can in trying to prevent disability. A lot of it comes back to that combating sarcopenia, and the only way that we can really do that is through the physical activity, particularly with the strength and balance training to improve that muscle strength and functional, you know, ability. I mean, even once patients get into residential care, we still want to try and make sure that we're maximising their independence, maximising their mobility, and maximising their own involvement with their ADLs. So providing as much assistance as they need, but not completely doing it for them if they don't need it. I think if you're thinking, I should say with diet, actually, thinking about chronic undernutrition, I just want to say that there is no evidence that I'm aware of, for example, that supplements improve function. So it's a difficult area, supplementation, isn't it? And so I think we just need to be a bit cautious with that, and obviously have dietitian advice as much as possible. And I want to say that there's no medications currently available that we know of to combat frailty. So giving your patients anabolic steroids aren't going to help anyone. And I have heard of one trial, the FIT trial, where they did have multifactorial interventions, including exercise, to target frailty. And they did reduce frailty and they did improve mobility, but unfortunately, there was no difference in falls. So this is still a huge area of research. And I guess we're just going to watch the space and see what else comes to light over the next few years and decades to see what else we can do to help our patients.
Wonderful. Thank you, Helen. So to conclude our podcast today, some take-home messages for our listeners, please.
Sure. Be as active as you can. Even if it's a little bit, that doing something is better than nothing, because every little bit counts towards better health. I think we want to encourage our patients to remain as socially connected as possible and to keep their brain ticking over as much as possible. I really encourage GPs to start documenting frailty on their patients and really have those conversations with family, because as we talked about, there are multiple adverse outcomes associated with frailty, and I think that shared decision making and setting of goals will be enhanced with more information, which includes a frailty assessment.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. If you're a New Zealand GP and would like to claim CPD points for listening to this podcast, our podcasts are eligible, so please log them. You'll also find a list of resources at our website, goodfellowunit.org. Thanks for joining us today.